Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's edition of the Perceptive Podcast. I am Josh Blaser, Game Wisdom's lead writer and owner. Joining me this week, my co-host is Game Wisdom's site designer and artist for Smugly Games, Kenneth Olm.
Hey there.
And our special guest this week, from the recently successful Kickstarter for Artisans, their lead designer, Charles Amos.
Hello, everyone.
It's great to have you on, Charles, and once again, congratulations on the Kickstarter.
Thank you.
Except for I donated, so...
Yes, you're a backer.
And I'm officially a backer.
Awesome.
Yeah, we finally got Ken to do a few Kickstarters.
Yeah,
and... He's been getting busy the last 2 weeks. He also did the Longest Journey Kickstarter last week.
Yeah, I also did Asylum, too, right after I donated to Artisan.
And Charles is special for the podcast for two reasons. First, he is our first designer on who has had a successful Kickstarter.
Sweet.
And he is also a local designer, as Artisans is based out of Philadelphia, right, Charles?
Yes.
And we are actually pretty close. I know Ken lives in Philadelphia, and I live very close in South Jersey.
Ah, nice.
All right. So by the time this podcast actually goes up, most people would have probably read our interview that we put up on the site. So for those who aren't too familiar with Artisans, could you describe a little bit about what the game's about?
Sure. Artisans is a 2D action platformer with a focus on online co-op and crafting your own weapons and gear. But you can craft them a lot more uniquely than in most games. Not only can you tweak their stats and mod them up, but you can also draw what they look like.
Yep, and the videos that you guys put up on the Kickstarter really show just how intricate you could design stuff. I know in the interview where we talked about the arrowproof beard and the character that you talked about, the one who has shoots syrup and butter out of two pistols.
Breakfast woman.
Nice. So with Artisans, now is this the first actual game that you developed as a designer, or have you worked on anything previous to this?
I've been in the industry for about 6 years and started at Game Lab as an intern, making casual games. Like I worked on JoJo's Fashion Show 2, which was sweet, and the licensed Top Chef game, stuff like that. But then I worked for a really long time on a game called Game Star Mechanic for about 4 years, I think, and started off as an intern on it, then a freelance designer, and eventually game design lead in its last 2 years. And we got that out to the public about 2 years ago, I think. It's a game somewhat similar to Artisans in one core respect, which is in Game Star Mechanic, it's an RPG, a single-player RPG, but as you go through missions, you earn sprites to make your own games with. So there's a creative component from the players that's worked into the game itself. So it's not a tool for making games solely. It's also a game about making games. And with Artisans, there's obviously a big creative component, but we've worked it into the game structure itself. It's not just a modding tool. It's like modding meets gameplay.
And it definitely looks amazing. And we've seen a lot of games over the last 3 years that have been giving the player a lot more freedom. There was, of course, Little Big Planet and Scribblenauts. Now, with those two games, the content was pretty much set. You always knew, you know, what would be the next level. Now, with Artisans, we talked about how the mission design differs from that. Could you explain a little bit more about how these missions play out in Artisans?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, one big difference, I think, between a lot of other games that offer creative expression, like Spore and Little Big Planet, things like that, is we have a really big focus on combat. So there is a goal that your creativity is driven towards. You want to make a really solid build for your character that looks cool and functions well, but specifically for combat. So the missions themselves are to challenge your creativity. In the same way Scribblenauts puzzles challenge, you know, how you're going to solve them, we're going to do that through giving really nasty, smart monsters to you and to your friends for you to take on together. And also, the missions will be generated semi-randomly, so while we will hand-make all of our levels, we'll give you a random set of those handmade levels, and also tweak little things about the monsters. So you can't just perfectly learn how to fight a Triton Trat, because this one may be smarter, faster, likes to block more often, runs away when injured more often. Little tweaks to just keep you and your friends on your toes.
That sounds really nice, having, so like the levels themselves are pretty much like wide open, like they're made up of like different zones.
Yeah, so it's you're really sort of fighting in multiple arenas. Think sort of Super Smash Brothers, except you can move amongst the arenas, and you may have a favorite one that you want to fight in, or one you want to avoid, one that's specifically difficult for platforming, one that the monster favors, and collectively these 10 arenas or so make up the whole wilderness that you're in on a mission, and the monster is also moving between these arenas.
One question I have actually about the mission design is, since the missions are generated somewhat randomly, what's like the basic concept, like the thought process for designing a mission in a game like Artisans, where you're never quite sure what exactly the player has available at the given time?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the main focus, we have mission types. There's hunting missions, which are relatively straightforward. It's to kill a big boss monster. There's also things like rescue missions, where you need to get to an NPC and bring them back to base. Infiltration, where you need to sneak into a location. Since it's also not linear, it's not as though you do mission one, then mission two, and we don't know what the player has at their disposal. It's really up to the player to read the description of the mission, see what the risks and what makes this mission unique, and create the build that they think is going to sort of be the hard counter to what we have in the mission. Of course, if you've never fought the monster before, you're just taking a risk when you go in there. Or maybe you're looking it up online, watching videos, trying to do some meta recon, but otherwise, when you go in there, it's going to be fresh.
If the monster design looks really interesting from the videos, in the videos you talk about how each monster and even the player has certain like critical points that can be hit for additional damage or to cause different effects.
Yeah, it's a nice coincidence. The puppet animation system that we're using is a good pair for us for multiple reasons. One is, it's what allows players to draw their own content and not have to animate each frame, right? If we did a sprite-based system, it would get unwieldy pretty fast. But by just drawing, a chest plate, and then we can animate that for you with the puppet system, it's not so bad. The other benefit we get from it, which is fantastic for gameplay, is since we are moving each of these static assets independently, each of those can have its own hitbox, its own stats, its own weaknesses. So not only is the animation system supporting our creativity and creative aspects of the game, but it's actually also the core of the combat system and the emphasis on aiming.
Well, here's a weird question about the... because you can customize any weapon you want, right? Mm-hmm. In terms of how it looks. So what about the concept of censorship? Because usually this is what I... whenever you give a tool to a user, allow them to draw something, it usually ends up being lots of penises.
Of course. So, yeah, for sure. And this is one of the first things that came up as we're thinking about the idea for the game. If you're going to give a lot of power to players, you could take a few routes. One is you could try to lock it down and say, no, everything is going to be quality controlled. There's going to be a moderation gate where we make sure every person's stuff is appropriate. We have a tight terms of service. We'll ban people who do inappropriate stuff, etc. We felt like that's sort of counter to a game that supports player creativity, so we wanted to do a bit of the opposite. And everyone's drawings get through right away. Instead, we're handling it on the other side. So if you're offended by what you see, we give you really quick tools to hide it for your account personally. You don't have to flag it and wait for some moderator to take it down. You just right-click on it, and it's gone. Every piece of gear has a default look, so it just switches it over to its default look. If it's extra offensive, or you feel like nobody should see what you saw, then there are also ways to flag it for a moderator to take it down or contact the person. But we really strongly believe that the community should be the ones who make the game look the way they want it to look, and not a set of developer standards that we enforce beforehand and sort of assume everyone's guilty.
Well, that's a really great approach to take it. Especially if you want to promote creativity, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Because then you don't have those certain limits. But then again, if it's self-regulated, I think for the most part, the community as a whole has a good sense of what most moral or not. So,
yeah, we're also thinking some of our fans have suggested things like being able to put a visible permissions tag on some stuff you create. So let's say you really want to make some extremely offensive content, but you just want to share it with your friends. Like, you don't want the public to see what you're about to make.
Okay, that's great.
If you could tag it so that you're already hiding it for everybody, you just want your friends to see it. Or say you've been working on a drawing and you're a little shy. You don't know if you want everyone to see your scribbles. Being able to just set the visibility for your group of friends to see it could also help with this.
Oh, well, talking about, you know, everyone being able to see it, is there any sort of like share systems of who you can take the items you create? Is that implemented?
We don't currently have the trading, but you know, it's definitely a top priority feature. I think there's a lot of games that have some ability to draw your own content or make your own stuff that don't also have multiplayer or a way to easily share it with people. And I think that's a big missed opportunity. So direct sharing with your friends, being able to just give them a drawing or give them a piece of gear you make, is definitely going to be in there. And a larger trading post where you can buy and sell any content that the community makes as well.
No, so talking about that, I think it has a lot of potential because, again, some people are more artistic than others. So, you know, they are probably going to be the one that's making a lot of the items for friends, like swords and special things that people make requests for. Just like artists in Artist Alley and conventions, they ask for commissions for certain things. And the same kind of system could be placed onto your game if you have this kind of system in place.
I think commissions are going to be huge. You know, the great artists are going to emerge. The people who not only draw well, but know how to draw well for our system. Like, they can make that pair of pants that's just perfectly connected among the joints to, it just looks sick, or the armor that comes together in special combinations for certain animations. So being able to find those people, message them and say, I will give you this many shinies if you make, you know, and you can like send them a scribble or something like, eh, it looks a little bit like this. That's going to be really fun, I think.
Yeah, and it's also an educational tool, too. For people that aren't very good at art, they can practice using your system, too. And just seeing how things look in motion.
Right. And arguably, you know, not all games have puppet animation systems, for sure, but the kind of constraints that we have, the canvas sizes and needing to cover the default looks so that your hitbox isn't inaccurate, and only you can change the hitbox, the size of your objects, but you do that on the mod side, as opposed to just drawing it larger. I think those constraints are pretty educational, as far as those are the constraints of art asset creation for games.
Speaking about the mods, during the Kickstarter videos, you showed off like how each mod basically affects like the item. Like, you had like a fire mod, it gives a weapon fire damage, and so on. Now, when the game is considered release, will there be more mods added, like, as time goes on, or are you going to stay with, like, a pretty strict list of what the effect of mods can be?
To me, personally, I think mods are sort of the cornerstone of the functional creativity, right? There's the drawing, which is sort of endless, and as soon as you have the ability to upload drawings, we can add some features to that, but there's already this infinite pool. On the functional side, the only way we could really get that unlimited feel is if we just let you script how your sword works, you know, and you could go nuts, but you won't have the balance in there. You can create stuff that's unfair. So our little mods that are small pro-con pairs are very important for that functional creativity. Because of that, we're absolutely going to continue to release those. It's a bit easier for us, too. It doesn't require any new art assets. They're usually just little... The pro-con pairs are little stat tweaks to things, making something faster but do less damage, something heavier but slower, things like that. Bumping those out is quite a bit easier for us, and I think the more of those we have, the combinatorial complexity of the combinations and stacks you can have of those is going to get crazy, and I think it needs to get crazy. Otherwise, yeah, your sword can look like anything, but if we've only got this pool of 20 mods, you're going to run out of unique combinations pretty quickly. So I think it's very important to have a really sizable pool of those mods, more important than lots of new monsters and crafts. I think mods are key.
Yeah, especially when you start adding in more missions and more content. Basically, the bigger the toolbox, the more the player will be invested in their character and in their designs.
Yeah, I compare it often to Magic the Gathering, even though they're in different genres, formats, and all that. The feeling of getting that new card, and just one new card, you could build a whole deck around that.
Mm-hmm.
I'd compare our mods somewhat similar to a new card in Magic. It's one small piece to a larger structure, the 60 card deck, but yeah, that's what creates the expressive nature. And every Magic card is pro-con too. There's nothing that's, I mean, there are things that are objectively better, but overall, most things are balanced with their cost.
Now, one question I have about the equipment. During the Kickstarter video, you showed off like a variety of, I guess, special equipment, like the grappling hook and stuff like that. In the actual game, can the player design equipment that goes like beyond what you have? Like, let's say if I want to design, you know, like a robot or, you know, a Gatling gun or something crazy like that. Is the engine able to take like objects like that you haven't even thought about and allow them to work in the game?
Not quite. So things like grappling hooks, rifles, swords, those sort of general structures, you know, the melee weapon that has this animation set, we call that a craft, and then you can give that art and tweak what it does, whether it's status effects, speeds, things like that, but more in the tweaking area. We don't have support yet for really creating a completely new craft on your side. Instead, we'll release new crafts over time. So we can release the Gatling gun or the laser cannon or, you know, the double jump boots, things like that. And we know we're never really going to be able to pump those out fast enough for the imaginations of players. So we also want to release our tools and get a true modding community working on the side as well. Maybe Steam Workshop if we're fortunate enough to be on Steam, to see what players are making on that side. Building that into the game itself is tricky, once again, because of that pro-con stuff. Too easy to make broken content. But if we can do it on a mod basis on the outside and then do community testing and voting to maybe bring some of that player-made content into the main game, I think that's really promising.
Now, speaking about the ongoing development of Artisans, in the interview, you said that the game is going to be basically an ongoing title. Now, do you see Artisans as having some form of an end game, or would it be something similar to like a game like Minecraft, where it's just you're just going to keep playing as more and more new content is added over time?
Yeah, definitely more like Minecraft. I think because of the semi-random missions and being able to release new monsters over time, there's also no leveling up. Content, crafts and mods and stuff are balanced from the get-go, so it's going to feel more like a Super Smash Brothers title in the sense of all the different characters are good for different situations, but it's choosing between their pros and cons rather than leveling one of them up to be better than others. You know, once again, I think also similar to Magic the Gathering, that's been an ongoing franchise for decades, and it's still interesting to see the new cards they release and keeps the game fresh because of how they change the game internally. I think especially with our content of crafts and mods and new challenges to use them on, we've got the ability to sort of evolve the game over time as well.
All right. Now, what were you saying about with the mods and how they're balanced? So you can't ever, like, upgrade a mod. You can't take, like, a fire mod and make it, you know, a super fire mod, right? They're basically locked in their exact design from creation?
Yeah, somewhat. So each mod is a pretty small little modular piece. So let's say I want to make a fire sword and I put a fire mod on. It's going to give me a little bit of fire damage, and I'm going to sacrifice a little bit of physical damage so that it stays balanced. But if I want that super fire mod, effectively what I'm going to do is add many fire mods since you can stack them onto a single piece of gear. So now it's extremely fiery, but it does no physical damage at all. So still balanced, but more extreme.
Now, are there any limits to how many mods you can have on a piece of item at this point?
Not at this point. we're sticking with let's keep it crazy and only trim it back once we realize we need to, or it's breaking. You know, it's something that we can do in playtesting, but we definitely want to stay on the side of enabling ridiculous decisions as opposed to preemptively preventing them.
And I think by letting it go wild, you're going to give it a very unique look.
Yes.
With all those mods on top of each other.
Mm-hmm.
Just hopefully it doesn't end up being the Guild Wars issue, because if you play Guild Wars 2, a big issue is when you have, like, I don't know, 40 people fighting one monster, the monster becomes a particle effect for the most part. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's all those weird magics.
You have to be careful with that too when you have all those guys attacking one character or one monster.
Now, for the actual game, is the limit for the characters going to be 4, or will there be able to have more players at one time playing a single mission?
Right now, it's just limited to 4 people in a party. It's for a few reasons, one being screen real estate, just being able to see your whole party fighting against one of these monsters in one arena. Another is, you know, technical reasons. There's walking around town with lots of people, you know, dozens, hundreds, is a bit easier for us to do on a technical side, but keeping track of all of your actions and doing good collision detection for all of your stuff while you're moving in arcs and things like that. 4 is something we know we can create a great experience for people.
Here's a weird question having to do with the concept of customization. Will you give the ability to customize animations? Can they manipulate the rigs in the future?
Yeah, in the future, I'd love to say yes. Certainly not in the beginning. Part of it is a difficulty on the user side. Just making animations requires a pretty robust tool. So we're putting more of our focus into missions, monsters, crafts, and that stuff before we make the modding tools. But we definitely want to open up all of the tools eventually. And there's also little bits of animation, like just doing animations in place, like, you know, frames of fire animation on a fire sword. That's even separate from, like, if you wanted to create a whole move set for a new type of, like, katana or something.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'd say the adding frames of animation to a single piece of gear is most likely going to happen in-game and happen a bit sooner as, like, a advanced setting in the workshop. Actually creating your own rig animations, I think, will be on the mod side, instead, like the modding side, mm-hmm. Outside of game, and then possibly working its way into the main game.
Yeah, I could see a lot of potential with that kind of modding tool, because you could really give your character a lot of, you know, instead of just visually, but also give its own personality by emotion.
Yeah, if they move uniquely, then they're completely different from everyone else's character.
Right, and then you can also animate a bunch of, like, you know how in a bunch of MMOs you have those different types of, like, taunts and dances and stuff
like
that?
Yeah, gestures.
You could do the same thing with your character.
And, of course, a bunch of them off the bat are going to be ridiculous. Oh, and just they're, like, ragdoll, you know, puppet flailing every direction.
Yeah, yeah, I'm sure there's someone that's not really artistically minded, and they'll just try to make him go, like, he's, like, freaking out, you know? Like, his arms start flipping in circles and stuff and just walk around town.
Yeah, that'd
people.
Be a fun gesture for, like, when you win a mission to just do your freak out animation.
Yeah, but I think that has a lot of potential, because like one thing I noticed in the video, like, does the facial expressions ever change or that kind of stuff?
Facial expressions, yeah. Since they're all static assets, they don't change if we added the changing single assets, like the frames of fire sword animation, we could also add in the future. You know, faces that look hit make different faces for situations, and you could draw each of the pictures for those so that they would happen when they're supposed to. You will end up with some funny stuff where every time you get hit, your head turns into a cat face. But the thing is, like, we're cool with it because you wanted that. You know, no one's going to get anything that they don't want. So we figure leaving that end of creativity open is fine.
Yeah, I mean, that's a level that I haven't actually seen in any game where they actually let you customize animation. So if you were to put something like that, I think that'd be really novel.
Yeah, so. I think that's definitely like a nice next step to go with the abilities for the players to create their own stuff. Yeah, we want to release features that expand that over time. That's a great next place to go.
One question I have, going back to like the idea of progression, as we talked about earlier, you say that Orisons is similar to Minecraft and how there's not really like an end game con. It's just going to be more persistent objects, more content added. Do you see, like, is there like any form of progression in playing Orisons, like going from, you know, like rusty equipment to shiny equipment, or from little enemies to bigger enemies?
Yeah, I would say there's a couple levels of that. One is just sort of basic complexity growing over time. So you won't start off with a full set of armor and weapons. So First off, there's just building out all of your slots. You have six passive artifacts, that's stuff like armor and augments, and then six active artifacts, which are like weapons and tools. So first, there's just building those. Then there's modifying those and making them more complex and having sets for any given scenario so that when you're fighting a Spangly Tom who's, you know, has a lot of projectile attacks, things like that, you have a more defensive build and a build that closes space better. For a Trit and Trap fight, you have things that can destroy its shield, stuff like that. So there'll also be progression in building out all of those sets, which will take quite a bit of time. Then there's also the new monsters that come out. Some monsters you can only... You'll probably only be playing those at higher skill levels. So there's also the skill level, which is as you win a mission, your skill level goes up by 1 point. And if you lose a mission, it goes down by 1 point.
Okay.
As your skill level increases, the complexity of the missions also grows so that you may have been fighting one Trit and Trat in the beginning, but now it's three or mixed with yet another monster or a new monster you've never seen, a more complex mission type, and generally just harder and harder and harder missions. So you can get that increased challenge feeling, increased rewards, and increased complexity over time that'll, I think, feed those really skilled players who feed on progress. But also for those players who aren't as skilled or aren't interested in that progression, you're never going to get stuck. Like, oh man, I can't beat this Spangly Tom, so I guess I'm done until I can figure it out. By having your skill rank lower, you'll always stay within missions that are possible for you to take on.
Here's a question. You said you lose a point when you lose a mission, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if one person's really bad, he can bring the whole team down, and then everyone loses a point?
yeah, technically. If you go in there with a whole party, and you've got one player who's so bad that he actually makes the entire team lose, then yeah, you would all lose a point together, as goes the team.
Good. Good. puts on the pressure to have a good performance.
Now there's a system to help this out too, which is the co-op level. We only have two levels. There's the skill level for actual achievement and missions, and the co-op level, which is really outside of the game itself. It's your rating of other people's teamwork performance. So if there's that guy who brought the whole team down because he really wasn't playing well with others, rushing in too fast, at the end of the match, you can just give them a vote down, and everyone's co-op level is the difference between their votes up and their votes down, sort of like a Reddit post. And when you go to form your teams and do your matchmaking, you're actually able to pick the people you go on missions with. So if you see he's got a co-op level of negative 20, just don't go on a mission with that dude.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds similar to what League of Legends is trying to do, because that has a very, like, volatile community. Because again, if you lose, the entire team loses rank, right?
Yeah.
That's horrible. So everyone gets really angry at you. So now they're putting an incentive system to vote for people that are, like, vote for people's, you know, cooperative skills at the end of the match. So that's supposed to help weed out the evils of that community. So it's cool that you already thought about that in your design.
I think the pressure is higher for something like League of Legends, the competitive nature of it, the fact that you're fighting other humans, and also in those games, MOBAs and League of Legends specifically, even just having one weak link is like, that can decide the match. If they don't have a weak link but you do, it's over. And Artisan's less so. It being co-op, if you've got one guy who's just hanging out at home base and really not pulling his weight, you still may do okay, because the missions aren't all made for just four people. It's possible to take them on with fewer.
I'm raising my hand right now as a weak link in League of Legends.
I don't even try that game because I'm so scared.
Yeah, it's rough for new people to get into. That's another difficult thing with competitive PvP. But, you know, for Artisans, it won't be as difficult to jump in by yourself. For one thing, you can solo for quite a while. I mean, arguably forever. But joining up with friends will definitely get you more rewards, more interesting challenge. And I really think the game... blossoms when you've got cooperative play too. Being able to be supported and support others, being able to attack a monster from two sides, gang up on it, that fun can really only come from the co-op experience.
Yeah. I have two questions regarding the actual monsters that you have for Artisans. First, will the game ever allow players to design their own monsters to be featured in the game?
Definitely on the same theme of the modding of animations and of new crafts and things. That will come with that package. I think once we're ready to get players making their own complex content, stuff that requires a lot of investment from them and a lot of complexity on their side. Making a monster, honestly, in our game is not that complex. It's a combination of, you know, still art assets, a little 2D rig, some animations, and our Lua script. And our Lua scripting is really simple. It's quite learnable for someone who doesn't program, in my opinion.
Okay. And that actually leads into my second question. What is, like, the typical time frame for how long it takes for you to come up with a monster, take it from, you know, an idea to actually in-game?
Yeah, that's a good question. We've only made a couple monsters so far, so I think we're going to speed up a lot more as we go. Since we're still making tweaks to our scripting system, making sure that we polish it up. But it can range in time depending on how complex its AI is, since it differs from monster to monster. But I'd say with only three people working on it, we can get a monster from idea to in-game playing against it pretty rapidly, like 2 weeks or so. Actually getting it crisp enough to release it to players, we would want to work on it for quite a bit longer, I think a month, 2 months.
Right. Ken, do you have any other questions regarding the design of Artisans?
No, I think it's a wildly awesome idea, and I really like the concept of the necessity of gaining the skills for a game like this over the leveling up system that we see in a lot of RPGs, so I'm all for it, and then, hey, I'm a backer.
Sweet.
All right, let's move on to the next part of this, and that is talking about the Kickstarter. Now, Artisans is your first Kickstarter project, is that right?
That's correct.
So we were wondering if you could just talk a little bit about like how you went about like setting up the Kickstarter, because we know we have a lot of people listening who are enthusiasts or independent developers who may be interested in going the Kickstarter route at some point.
Yeah, we had this in the plans for, I mean, I suppose since we started, but we really only, which was around this time last year. However, we really only started production on planning the Kickstarter and making content specifically for it, I'd say in August or September. I guess it was actually early October. We had been planning it before then, but we started production in early October. I don't know if that sounds long to a lot of people out there or short, but the video is just so important, you know. So we put a lot of effort into all of our videos, which is, when the Kickstarter page launched, it was the main Kickstarter video with our interviews, and showing off game content, but then also a gameplay concept trailer, which we had right below that on the page. And yeah, we put a lot of effort into that while also continuing to work on the game on the side. But because for a lot of small indies like us, this Kickstarter money goes a really long way, and it's very important to get it. It was worth dividing our resources and putting a lot of effort into making the Kickstarter page really good. I'd say vast majority went into those videos. Putting together the little art assets and text afterwards honestly wasn't that much. We put up the SoundCloud soundtrack album for on the Kickstarter page as well, and Adam has been working on that for a long time. But he didn't specifically make it for the Kickstarter page. It was just a matter of putting that content on the page.
Yeah, the video definitely seems like an important aspect, especially for a interesting title like Artisans, where it may be difficult to, you know, explain to someone, you know, how exactly is modding work, or what can you actually customize on a character.
Yeah, I mean, video games are called video games for a reason. They are such a visual medium, and I think being able to see it in motion, see it in action, it's still not as good as getting your hands on it and really feeling what it feels to run around and jump and see all of the systems as they come to you. But I think without a video, a dry text or even just image explanation of a game usually falls flat.
Yeah, and we've seen that over the last few months with a lot, since Kickstarter really blew up after Double Fine that we talked about before the podcast, everyone is, you know, jumping on the Kickstarter bandwagon. We've seen, you know, everything from, like, just, like, a still image to, you know, someone like you guys who create, like, a full-blown, you know, concept video with footage from in-game for it.
Yeah. I think that's what you gotta do now. It's really the first thing people see. People are used to watching videos of games. It's a great opportunity for you to not only show the game concepts, also art, show them your team, and build that trust, because with Kickstarter there isn't a direct product that you're buying immediately. You're buying a product that is not yet fully made. I think trust is really arguably the core to the Kickstarter, like, backer to creator experience, and it's building that trust.
So I have a question about your Kickstarter. How did you come up with the original estimate of cost?
That's really hard. We went back and forth in the team for quite a while, because if you want to make like an ongoing game, Kickstarter is not a perfect fit for that. They really want you to have a finite end goal and ask for exactly the amount of money you predict needing to reach that end goal. So for our end goal, we picked just our alpha. We know that we're not like famous or anything, so we can't ask for like the 2-3 million that people are asking for. So we also did a lot of research on other Kickstarter projects, teams that have about the same exposure or experience as us, how much they had raised, so that we could keep ours realistic. But then also, we did have to dig into our budget and say, like, all right, to create a satisfying alpha that really is a true alpha in the sense of has all of the features that are required to make this the game it is, to make it a unique experience, to make it really artisans and not just a like a platformer demo or something. What would that cost? And luckily, we could make pretty accurate estimates because we've been in development for a year now and have our staff. We know how long it's taken them to make things. We know what their rates are. And we can add that all up and with our feature list for alpha, see what that is. And that was, I think it was 38K or so. And we only asked for 30K, but that's because we were able to get funding on the outside for another 10K on top of that. So the combined 40K was going to be enough. Luckily, we raised 52, so yeah. We're well above what we needed for that alpha. So that's going to buy us some runway afterwards.
One other question regarding the pricing. In the Kickstarter, the basic pledge to get the game, I believe that was $15. Mm-hmm. When the game is officially released, is the game still going to cost $15, or is it going to cost more than that for someone to buy a copy of Artisans?
Well, we definitely want to give those Kickstarter backers who took the risk with us a benefit. So we'd always plan to charge a bit more than $15. We don't know exactly how much it'll be, but all of those backers definitely got a discount at every level. So the lifetime guys who got like 3 copies for their friends and lifetime soundtracks and expansions for life, $60 for all that. It'll be a bit more later on. So there was a big benefit for backers this past month.
Now, how did you come up with your rewards? How did you choose them?
I wanted them to be simple. I didn't want too many. So we just have 10 tiers. I wanted them to be like nameable and for them to capture some sort of concept. I found a lot of rewards on other Kickstarter pages were a little bit amorphous. I wasn't quite sure what I'd be getting. So having like it be, there's just straight, you get the game. I think like that is what most people look for. And our backer numbers play that out too. I think most projects do. It's like, that's your vast majority of people. They're just like, all right, in my head, I'm pre-ordering your game by doing this. Then up from there, I think common ones are soundtrack, then I really liked our $40 tier that was getting the game for you and 3 friends for like a party. It's just a good fit for our game in particular. And I think up from there, we made our tiers like artisan specific. So it was stuff like getting to make a craft with us or getting unique Kickstarter exclusive gear, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Now, one question I have, going back to what you said, I think you spent a few months coming up with the overall pitch for Kickstarter. When you guys first started developing Artisans, did you have Kickstarter in mind for coming up with the money for it, or did that just develop over the course of creating the prototype of it?
We've had a pretty like multivalent strategy for funding. We started off with some family and friends investment, and the company that Kai and I worked for previously invested in us a little bit too, so we're able to take that money, and that funded our first year. Kickstarter is definitely a piece of that. That's the money's going to help so much with our bridge to the alpha. And once we have that, it's a bit more easy to raise money since we can show user traction, things like that, and have much more concrete product for anyone else to look at. But also, I think one of the best benefits, it's not just the money from Kickstarter, it's the people. It's you know, that just got you a ton of interested strangers. You know, it's not family and friends. It's like people who just like the idea of your game. They're going to be critical. They're going to be demanding. And they are going to play your game because they put money down.
I was just talking about to another developer recently about the benefit of Kickstarter and how, you know, it is a viable option now because it gives you an audience right away. Because when you release a game and you know, to the ether, you don't know if it's going to hit or miss. But if you have a base already that already put money down, you have a higher chance for them to be just as invested as you are in creating your game.
And that's great. I mean, games more than other media, I think, really thrive on that feedback and early feedback so that you can make critical changes for your players. I wonder sometimes with games that that come out and there's just some really odd decisions that were made. Like, did they play test this with strangers? did they get the feedback they needed? And most importantly, did they get it early enough and in time to actually make some of the bigger changes? Because I know how hard it can be to make a change once you're a good 3 or 4 years into your production. You don't have the same flexibility. So I think extremely early playtesting with large groups so that you get a very diverse voice. You can't just have, you know, your pool of 20 friends play your game. You need that 1,000 people, 100,000 people voice.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of times where people play. Like, there's a lot of less plays nowadays that go over older games, and they always have that question of what were they thinking.
Yeah.
Like right now there's Sonic 06. There's someone doing a very big stream of Let's Play on that. And it's one of those games that you can't believe it passed through that many eyes and was allowed to be, you know, produced.
And now, like, when you're making the game and you've played that first level for the 300th time, or maybe you're just skipping it with, like, a little developer tool, you can't be trusted. you know, you came up with the idea, good for you, but, like, now you have no idea what your game is like.
Because you're always so busy doing all the other things. You're like, you know, someone else will do it. And, you know, it's good enough. I think it was good. But then you're clouded because you're just, you know, distracted.
Yeah, and the game isn't played by that person with that experience. It's played fresh, first time, beginning, middle, and end. You know, what does that experience look like? And you've lost sight of that.
And we see that a lot in a lot of, like, independent strategy games, like, with, like, these just ridiculous UIs and so much complexity that you need to watch, like, a 2-hour movie on exactly how to play the game.
You talk about Crusader Kings, too?
Yes.
Not to name names, but...
He made me get it, and I shut down after, like, I don't know, 2 minutes or so, after the tutorial was part of the game, figuring out how the tutorial itself worked. I was like, I can't. I need to invest like a week into learning this game if I'm going to even try it.
You need a tutorial for the tutorial, I think.
Pretty much.
there was actually a pregame to the whole thing, too, because I got it with all the DLC, and there was like, I don't know, 100 DLC. I had to do it by hand.
Whoa.
So it is a lot of talk is about this game, but it is one of the heaviest, you know, boundaries to entry again to games I've ever seen in my life, so. I'll give it a shot. It's equivalent to like one of those like old school war board games that you see in those conventions.
Right, right. And you just seeing them from across the room, you're like, oh man, I don't know if I can play that.
doesn't it terrify you slightly? I'm like, oh, I don't know. I don't know about this.
Yeah, it like splits gamers. It either excites you, or you're like, oh my god, it looks so complex and immersive. Or you're like, I will never learn that or want to.
That is another world I can't enter.
Yeah.
And the best part is that game is considered like somewhat like on the higher end of accessibility compared to a lot of the even more obtuse strategy games out there, which I don't want to show Ken because it may scare him away.
I'm already scared.
It's funny because in general, sort of all video games now are a little bit inaccessible. Mm-hmm. Like if you didn't, especially like on console or AAA stuff, if you didn't grow up with games, even just dual analog stick control of character and camera is like a huge hurdle to get over. And most developers now are like, we can pretty much assume the vast majority of our player base knows how to do that, so we're not even going to have a tutorial on how to use these controls. We're going to jump right into what makes our systems unique.
Yeah, that's good. There's nothing like the first tutorial being press left to move left.
Yeah.
I would not know how to do that on my own. Thank you.
I know, and I really appreciate it when games do skip that stuff. I mean, arguably, I think if a discrete tutorial itself needed to be made sort of on top of the game in the beginning, there's a little bit of a design failure there. I think ideally the first few levels of your game, or the first few minutes of the experience, should have a tutorial sort of baked into it. The way that Nintendo develops their Mario, Zelda games, there's very rarely, at least in the past, there were discrete tutorial with HUD that pops up and tells you what buttons do. It's more like, don't worry, this is a safe place. Just mess with the buttons and you'll figure it out. You can't die right now, so just like mess around.
I think Crusader King showed me a movie, and I'm like, oh, I don't want to do this.
No.
And then you have to go like on YouTube and watch, you know, like videos other people made to try to explain it to their friends of how to play it.
Yeah. I mean, that shows great fan love for the game. And it is a true shame, since I think many very complex games could be loved by more people if they had a bit more of a gentle learning curve in the beginning.
Well, there's a novel thing to the game, right? Isn't there like a Wikipedia connection to it, so you can actually look up real people as you play against them? Like real, like historical figures. So they bring in all those factors in. So it's an extremely complex game. I'm sure it's very rewarding.
But that, right, exactly. That the richness is there.
The entry is just insane, though.
Yeah. So. All right. Going back to the Origins Kickstarter, one area that your Kickstarter differed from others was in the form of the stretch goals. In most cases, stretch goals are, you know, they add more content, they add completely new gameplay features. I know, like, the Longest Journey, they just hit their goal of, I think, what was it, 900,000?
Linux, yeah.
And now they got stretch goals all the way up to, like, 2 million. But with Arsons, you went a different approach with the pets. Could you talk a little bit about the reasoning behind that?
Yeah, stretch goals are tricky for us. Since we always wanted to be an ongoing game, if we have stretch goals where we say, oh, now we're going to release a new type of weapon, something like that, it implies we weren't going to do that unless we got this money. So for those people who bought Immortal and were going to get expansions for life, it devalues their purchase and also creates sort of an odd impression. We're promising ongoing content on one side and yet locking content down unless we reach a certain goal on the other. Because of that, stretch goals were tricky for us, but we know how much they're expected in the Kickstarter experience, despite not actually being a good fit for us. Because of that, we thought, well, what could we offer? Something that we wouldn't normally make and is sort of auxiliary. And we thought, oh, we could have, even though we'll release these pets and these pet crafts over time, we could make exclusive pets that we make ourselves. And since they're very difficult to make and require a lot of materials, and we can make something that looks really nice, we could give that to all of our backers and make it more of a bounty system, where it's not that we're unlocking content we wouldn't have made otherwise, but it's more like, thank you so much for spreading the word and helping us get to this higher level. Here's a present for everybody.
Oh, right, I get a present.
And the pets, people during the actual game who haven't pledged, they can still create their own pets in-game, right?
Yeah, exactly. So as soon as we released the mini trip pet and the Torpin pet, all of our backers, all the Kickstarter backers, will have, what did I name him? Scorpio, I think. Archibald Scorpio, that's right. They'll get him and Sun Wukong, the Monkey King, in their inventory vault. So those pets they'll have, and nobody else will get those, and it'll be that custom art, custom mods. But everyone can learn the pet crafts and make their own pets. These are just special exclusive pets for the backers.
Now, one area that Kickstarter has changed since Double Fine came and, you know, blew it wide open for everyone is with the concept that they're asking the developers to basically explain the risk behind the project. Now, as an independent company, do you think that there's more risk in pledging to a game like Origins compared to when you see, like, these big companies, like the Wildman Kickstarter or Project Eternum, when they're asking for, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars of money to fund their games?
I'm really glad they added those sections, the risks and challenges. I think a lot of developers don't want to talk about that stuff. It's a risky business, and it's hard to talk about some of those things sometimes. But we were really happy to have the opportunity to spell it out talk about the things we're thinking about, because we want you to know that we're thinking about those risks and we take them very seriously. For independent games versus, you know, something like Wildman or bigger projects, I think it's a matter of scale. You know, like, they're taking on a lot more than we're taking on, and that's why they need their millions. I think with scale, there in some ways is increased risk because that money is going so many different directions at such high levels that it's a lot easier to misspend and not see where things go. With our really small team, our six-person team, we see where every dollar goes on a very small scale. Less money goes further, and we can cut our costs a lot more easily. We're not paying for office space. We're not paying for, like, a big marketing team. So I think because of that, it's a project-by-project basis, but I'd say you could definitely have an indie game project that is way riskier than the AAA and vice versa.
All right. Now, yeah, I think, as you were talking about, a lot of people don't really consider, you know, think about their risks, and that has always been, like, a major problem, even in other businesses. Like, when you're trying to convince someone that what you say, you know, that you have, you know, the next big product, or you're the guy for the job, without explaining to someone, like, the risk, it sort of makes you look less qualified than you would normally be.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. Not acknowledging that there are costs to these things. There are places where things could go wrong. Like I was saying before about Kickstarter being founded between creators and backers on a trust relationship, part of this is an opportunity to be in the development process with the creators and getting more input than you would have gotten in projects in the past. So while there are, I think there's actually sort of the same risks as with any of those projects in the past, it's just now we're exposing that to the players themselves and saying, this might never be made unless you guys want to back it. So are you willing to take that leap with us? Do you think it's a good enough idea that it's willing to take this risk and back us? I agree that I think many people may come into it a little bit too cavalierly and treat it more as a store. And I know that Kickstarter themselves really doesn't like that approach because it's missing out on the bigger thing that's happening, right? It's not a store. These products don't exist. Instead, you have this opportunity to sort of join the team on the level that the publishers used to join in on. But that could be you and your player friends now. Wouldn't you like to have that voice that the publishers used to have more so?
Yeah, it's not like with these projects that they've already been creating, you're just looking for money. It's basically, if you don't get this money, this it will never get made, or it will be a lot harder and longer for someone to actually develop this project.
Yeah. And it definitely does put the pressure on marketing. It's like the best pitch wins, or like if you can put a fancy name on it or reference games that are cool. And I think definitely some of that is pretty negative. You know, games aren't their marketing campaign. They're what they feel like and play like when you're in them. So I'd say to, you know, future Kickstarter backers, like, really look for that. Look for what seems to be the heart behind what's going to make the game different and special. Would this game be made any other way but Kickstarter? And also, do you trust the team? Do you like the team? And have they convinced you that they can really pull it off?
Now, one question I have regarding how you set up the Kickstarter is the concept of setting the prices for your various rewards. How did you, like, come up with, like, how much you wanted, you know, someone to pledge to get the digital download song, or, like, coming up with the visionary of that cost of $5,000 to design an entire mission scenario?
Well, we combined it with some research from other Kickstarter projects to see what sort of market standards were, plus costs on our end for how much we think they would take staff time, as well as what we felt that they were worth. So with the $15 game, we've seen that that's become very common across Kickstarter for the sort of base price to get in on games. And we thought it was a good fit for us as well, since it was close to the price points we'd been thinking about and the value we think we're offering. But for the higher tiers, when it comes into, like, inviting someone to come and make content with us, a lot of the content that we're offering them to join in on is tricky to make, involves a lot of people on staff. You know, a lot of specific production going in, but also the meetings to get them ready. So we made sure that whatever that cost was for the reward would cover all of those expenses. But we also came in a little under that, since we know that it'll have value for the community overall and not just for this one person.
Now, one area that I want to get your opinion on is that we've been having talks, and Ken and I have been discussing between us, if Kickstarter is starting to run its course. Like, are people getting tired of pledging money towards projects? So I was just wondering, what is your opinion on that, seeing as how your Kickstarter just ended with a success?
Well, in doing our research on Kickstarter and projects and press, we did notice definitely far more negative press on Kickstarter than was there even 6 months ago. Articles talking about certain project creators not fulfilling their rewards, or this sort of Kickstarter fatigue that we've been hearing about. I think there was definitely a bubble. Maybe that bubble's not bursting, but coming down. And I think that's natural and probably a good thing. I'd like to see not necessarily fewer projects on Kickstarter, but the standards of those Kickstarter projects being higher, and I think backer savvy being higher, so that it was such a new thing and sort of delightful to people when we were in the Double Fine period, and I think still is to a lot, that it's just like exciting to see that game that you never thought would be made. It's exciting to see the new indie project and be able to back that, but I hope where we're headed is just more realistic Kickstarter. It still exists. It's still fantastic for indie developers and developers who can't make the games that they've always wanted to make. But there are less of those marketing only, I'll say, games where they don't have much substance there. They're more just like giving you a cool pitch, and they may not be able to actually execute on it. I think the savvy will get to the point where backers will know what projects are trustworthy and which ones aren't.
Yeah, definitely. Especially have we been seeing that a lot of big name designers have jumped on with Kickstarter following Double Fine. Like, we've had Obsidian with Project Eternity. I think we had like some old school developers. I think Roberta Williams wanted to do like an adventure game on Kickstarter. And recently, John Schaefer from Firaxis and Civ 5 fame is doing his Kickstarter for his new game as well.
Yeah, and I think many of them have been successful. Probably the majority of those the big name developers have been successful because they're able to rally that fan base that they've developed over many years. And having a place for them to do that where they didn't really have that place before, I think that's great. There will be some developers who maybe overreach or can't rally their network as much. And we'll see more of that over time. But I think, yeah, it's a coming into balance as opposed to Kickstarter heading to a place where it no longer exists. I think it'll exist, and the crowdfunding will really find its place. It just won't be the same as it is right now.
And don't forget there's also more competitors out there like Indiegogo and such. Mm-hmm. That'll prop up and arise and challenge its throne.
Yeah, because Kickstarter is—it's easy for me to forget, but it's not just for video games. It's for all these creative projects. When I check KickTrack for stats and whatnot, it's just so clear how much video games are dominating the amount of pledged money on Kickstarter, and that really happened with Double Fine, I think. Mm-hmm. Indiegogo supports multiple projects as well, but somehow it seems like this fit for games has been really tight. I wonder if we'll see if there already is a site that's just crowdfunding for games.
Yeah, I think Indiegogo is more for film, right? And Kickstarter has some film projects, but more of it's on Indiegogo than the other one.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think Kickstarter started with predominantly film as well.
You know, it's interesting though. I was looking at some of the numbers in terms of like what's the top selling or like highest amount made for films for Kickstarter, and the second highest was a documentary on Pony Culture, Brony Culture, and My Little Pony. I was like, wow, of all the great films, like that was the one that made the second highest. That's pretty cool. Because that definitely would never have been made at a professional level.
Right, if it wasn't for something like Kickstarter, right?
Yeah.
You've got this massive, and a fan base not only that's large, but would spend a lot of money to see that documentary, you know? Like,
yeah, they're dedicated, you know? It's always
right,
good to
exactly.
have that kind of fan base.
And I think that's true for the adventure game genre, things like that. The fan base might be smaller and, you know, scare publishers off for those reasons, but they are willing to pay more, I think, in
so,
general.
So when I heard Linus Journey was coming out, I was willing to throw all my wallets at them. Because they ended Dreamfall in a cliffhanger. So
yeah.
That's pretty evil to do. And then Funcom was like, all right, no more Longest Journeys, just MMOs.
Yeah.
Just MMOs that don't make money.
Now, one thing about Indiegogo that I think also makes it a little less popular for game projects is that with Indiegogo, whether or not the project meets its goal, the pledge basically still gets sent to the person. They'll just receive a bigger cut. So if they were, you know, only like a thousand or a few thousand short of their goal, the guy will still get his money, and that may or may not have been enough to develop the game to begin with. So there's definitely, you do need to have more trust using Indiegogo than you do with Kickstarter. As with Kickstarter, basically you won't receive 1 cent unless it at least meets what you're asking for to begin with.
Yeah, I think that was a pretty brilliant move on Kickstarter's part. It's great to know that like you won't be charged unless they get the money they need, because it creates a couple things, a lot of good incentives. One is it challenges the project creator to really come up with a realistic number and not just say, oh, I need a dollar. And you know, anything I get over that's gravy. We'll just be stretch goals. That's it. Or they just ask for, you know, 400 million and they're happy to take your 5,000 and buy a bunch of pizza and beer.
Now, with Artisans, I know some developers, after the Kickstarter is over, will still allow people to pledge for either some of the rewards or just to pre-order the game afterwards. Are you planning on doing that on your main site?
We are a little bit. I think not right away. You know, we want to make sure that those Kickstarter backers get the benefit that they should get for taking the early risk with us. So, you know, right now, since there's nothing to buy and download yet, I think it makes less sense to start selling it right away. I'd rather do a Minecraft model where we can sell you alpha access, but I want you to be able to download the alpha when you do that. So we're probably going to, we've got plenty of playtesters, plenty of folks to show off the early game to right now. So I think we probably won't sell again until we're ready to actually let you download something.
And I believe you said that you're planning on releasing the alpha, I think, in like 5 or 6 months?
Yeah, I think we'll start bringing in our earliest sort of pre-alpha playtesters maybe in the next couple of months, and then do a bigger opening for our backers in the summer, and probably in the fall, opening that up to people outside of the Kickstarter backers as well.
One other question I have is, when I'm looking at the rewards for Artisans, there's very few in terms of physical rewards. Do you think, as you come with the pricings for like the various rewards, are like what kind of considerations have to go into when you're coming up with a physical reward or not?
Physical rewards, yeah. When we're picking what rewards we wanted to have, something that we wanted to make sure that what didn't happen, which I've heard from a lot of other projects, friends who've led Kickstarters, is the amount of time that had to go into just satisfying those rewards, making the t-shirts, making the figurines, boxing it up, shipping it all out. It took so much time and money out of actually developing the product. So we wanted to really align our rewards and make sure that any one of those rewards we're working on also pushes us closer to finishing the overall project itself. I mean, not just because we wanted to make it easier for ourselves, but I think it makes sense. I think those rewards should help the project to meet its goal, as opposed to really be something sort of outside of what the game is. So that's why we didn't do physical rewards like t-shirts or plushies or stuff. But we've got time to do those later, I think. But for the Kickstarter, we wanted to put all of our energy into making that summer deadline and putting all of our resources into that while also satisfying the rewards.
Yeah, I've been doing some research on my end as well, just looking at just the cost of getting stuff printed, just, you know, for our site and for some other ideas. And, I mean, that stuff gets expensive very quickly.
And that's eating into that Kickstarter money, which hopefully that was added to the amount of money you need, because it's easy to underestimate that stuff or miss a cost somewhere, miss some sort of shipping cost that you weren't thinking of.
All right. So, Ken, do you have any other questions, like, regarding Kickstarter or anything?
Well, I do have an interesting discussion about what we had last week about the future Kickstarter. Maybe you can share some light of, you know, some of your opinion on it. So we had a cast, had a guest caster talking about how he doesn't like the system Kickstarter has with the reward system. He likes the concept of a commission system. And he was like, he felt like if he had more incentive, like it would get a small chunk of profit from the game itself, even it being a percentage, he would have more of a reason to put money into the project. How do you feel about that? And what do you think about a commission system?
It is really interesting. I mean, arguably, the Kickstarter backers for Artisans really are investors, at least in their mindset, like that they're taking a risk on something that may not happen and really hope that it does. And for that risk, they get these rewards. But I like that other guy is saying is like, if Artisans makes it huge, it's not as though their reward grows to meet that that proportionality, and it seems like maybe it should. What I'd like to see either is another crowdfunding site that does focus on sort of micro investment, and or maybe options on Kickstarter to do micro investment. I think they made the right choice with doing this reward system. It's simple on their end. It has very, very simple sort of finite system. It does function a little bit like a store in the sense of you have purchased this single object. Once I have that single object for you, I will give it to you. And that's the end of our relationship. Something like a micro investment is going to have really long-term effects and possibly, you know, could be really great for those early investors or really bad. I think there might be, you might give more money than you should because you're really hoping the gamble will pay off. But I think there's room in the market for it. I'd love to see something like that happen. It does feel a little bit strange that you come and take this early risk, but you won't really benefit tremendously if it totally takes off and you were there and you were part of the reason it got funded.
I mean, I could see both points.
Yeah.
And I like the Kickstarter, the model for it. And again, I think of it more of as the two things. One, it's kind of like a charity because you're donating to a cause you think is worthy, a game that you would never ever be created or developed because it's too risky. But you also get something back from it. So those rewards, it's just a nice benefit. Not only do you get the game, but you get stuff added on top of it. So mm-hmm. I think that is a pretty nice system. And I think the commission system, if for it to work, I think that the people that are investing in the project need to put, you know, higher amounts if they're going to get some sort of return. I think that would something that needs to compensate. It can't be like, you can't get 0.001% of all profits from all time for this game being sold. I think it should be obviously a much higher kind of reward. But I think that it's something that's definitely going to be exploited in the future, for, you know, in a positive way. And it'd be interesting the future of crowdfunding.
I think that's part of it. I think what you're pinpointing to is it's like a higher level up from it. People who are really serious might want to go in on an investment system. And the thing is, Kickstarter is not preventing anyone from also raising investment outside of it. Places like AngelList are great places for you to put your company profile up, find other angel investors, and do something larger like this, where they would buy a stake in your company. They would have equity, and as your company grows, they would profit from that too. So, you know, that's a little bit of an avenue for it, but it sounds like this guy's talking about something in between, which is like crowd investment.
Right. And I mean, it does give some incentive because you can think about it. Sometimes you back up multiple projects and just like live off that. Maybe it's a game where they're all successful, like kind of like penny stocks, you know?
Yeah. So yeah, you'd really be a game investor. And if you're someone who knows games well and you're able to find those early hits, that would be kind of a fun way to get a little extra money.
Yeah, but again, you have to be a higher amount, I would say. You can't just put like a dollar. I'm like, all right, or $15, and that's it. You know,
and the complexity of managing your hundreds of thousands of investors, whom has to get fractions of pennies.
I think another part of the complication of that is that with a lot of like the niche Kickstarters, chances are the people who donate the money were going to be the extent of the people who are actually going to buy it when it was released. So. Afterwards, it may be harder to get a lot more profit as, you know, everyone who won the game already, you know, pledged for it at the time.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. It's it would only make sense to invest in those things where you feel like it's the unknown project, the unknown team, and it's going to explode, right? But for something like Double Fine or some of these bigger guys who, like, they have their target market and they were able to nearly reach all of those people. Yeah, you're right. They're not really going to sell any more copies. That is the amount of people they're going to sell to. So it's nice that that group got to fund that project to make it exist. But with the Kickstarter model, it makes a lot of sense because that is the end of the story. It got funded, it got made, it got sent to the fans. That's it. That's the end of it.
Now, one other question I have regarding for your opinion. As we were talking earlier about how a lot of people are looking at these big projects, you know, the ones like Project Eternity, like the multi-hundred-thousand-dollar projects, that if they fail, do you think that their failure will sort of trickle down and affect, like, the independent level, like people like you who are aiming for, you know, only, like, thousands instead of hundreds of thousands?
It's possible. It's hard to say. I think if there's a bunch of high-profile projects that don't satisfy their backers, people are going to feel burned, for sure. They're going to feel like they shouldn't trust Kickstarter at all, possibly, on the more extreme end. Or it could send a lot of people to say, all right, I'm not going to do the big ones. I'm just going to do the small ones, the ones that look like they're shooting for a pretty realistic goal, stuff like FTL. You know, maybe things that are already nearly finished and just need a little bit of push. Maybe they're just funding the soundtrack for the game or something like that. I could see some people retreating back to that and just backing those more realistic things. But it's hard to say. I don't think in total a lot of high-profile failures would completely end crowdfunding. I think it's still going to be there. Also, you know, a lot of people crowdfund their projects just from their networks, and they don't really reach a ton of strangers. And for those projects, I think those will always exist. It's just a great way to raise money from your friends, family, you know, your Facebook network, things like that. Get the word out. Have a central place for the funds to come in, fund rewards for your family, friends, and you can probably get 300, 400 backers maybe that way if all of your team pitches in and maybe raise a few thousand dollars.
Okay.
Hard for a game since games are so expensive, but yeah. I think that's ideal for, like, you want to make a new album or you want to make a short video. And in some ways I feel like Kickstarter may be it's a less risky fit for those projects, so in some ways it's a better fit for those projects.
One question that I have that I forgot to ask you earlier about Artisans and the Kickstarter was one of the tricky parts about putting up a Kickstarter concept is knowing at what point in the state of the project to actually put it up. I know some people, as we talk about, you know, they do it like the second they have, you know, like the first bit of concept art. Others wait till, you know, they have, you know, half the game to almost the entire game done. With Artisans, how did you decide at what point you were going to take what you have and put it on Kickstarter?
In some ways, it was a little bit of a reverse. It was like, when do we want to do our Kickstarter, and what do we know we need to have at that point? Let's make sure we get to that point. Let's give ourselves a deadline. I'd say what's going to happen when you run your Kickstarter is you're going to be asked a billion questions. And the less stuff you show people, the less you have in your video, the more questions you're going to get. So from a designer perspective, I think the designer really needs to have a very tight handle on what they're going to do and not just tons of, like, oh, we could do this, we could do that, haven't really thought of this, haven't thought of that. Mm-hmm. We need to have much more crisp answers, still flexibility, but know where you're going and what the boundaries of your project are. From a technical side, I think your programmers need to think of what's feasible, and make sure that it's possible. Make sure your technology allows for the things that you're hoping to make. Those are probably the two highest priority things. As far as, like, what state your actual game should be in, getting your technology to the point where you can get in there and prove some of your design theories, some of the features you wanted to have, make sure that they're possible for, not just possible, like, in the universe, but possible for your team, you know, that you guys know how to do this. For us, we had never made a a true like synchronous online multiplayer platform before. That was one of the things that we hadn't done. So in the past year, our programmer knew to focus on that first. He's like, I'm going to take on the unknown challenge first. And so he did that. We got online multiplayer working, and we could sort of breathe a sigh of relief that we can go into Kickstarter and promise online multiplayer and not just be blowing smoke. Like, we did that. We have that. You know, that's not something we have to worry about.
Yeah, and the gameplay concept is definitely, as we talked about, very important. We saw that with Planetary Annihilation, where they technically didn't have like any like real gameplay to show, but they showed exactly what the game was going to be headed for. And like with Arisons, while there's not like a huge amount of, you know, people wandering around the town or going on missions, you guys showed, you know, the customization aspects and a little bit about how that plays out when you have a group of friends, you know, taking out, you know, one of the big monsters.
Yeah, we figured it was most important to show those core things, so we focused mainly on crafting and combat. Then in our video updates during the Kickstarter, we filled in more of those sort of technical details or gameplay details, like how exactly do you go on missions, how does the matchmaking work, what are some special features involved in the game once you're in it. So we thought crafting and combat were so core that that's what was going to get you excited about the game, and that's where our main focus as developers lies. That's what we're putting the most effort into. And then getting into the specifics after that with update videos, I thought, went pretty well.
Mm-hmm. Now, with all the backers asking you questions, did you already like have everything somewhat planned out as, you know, if someone asked you something, you already had that thought? Like, did anyone like throw you for a loop with a question that they asked during the Kickstarter?
Oh, sure, yeah. I mean, there are a few questions where I had to talk to the team. We had to come up with some design decisions. But because we had most of the design already there, it wasn't too difficult to come up with how we would handle unique scenarios. And I think one of them was we have this thing called the Mercenary Board, which is where you can put up a mission to get other people to volunteer to it. And someone wanted to know if they could lock that mission so that certain people can't see it, or that you could maybe skip the Mercenary Board if you already had friends in a party with you. So we'd been toying with the idea of having a party system in addition to the Mercenary Board. They slightly overlap, so I usually lean towards the side of going elegant and just having one system if one system will suffice. But I can see the prevalence for that use case of wanting to just skip the Mercenary Board, go on a mission with your friends and never really look at it. So we said we're most likely going to add the ability to party up with your friends and be able to skip the Mercenary Board. So yeah, I think people will definitely, especially as you give them answers, they're going to ask that really specific question that wrinkles things a little bit after that. And it's going to lead you to new territory for sure.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the most popular questions that I see when I'm looking around the various Kickstarter projects is if a game's going to be, you know, just PC available, it's going to be Linux, mobile, Mac. With Arisons, are you planning on having release on multiple platforms, or is it just strictly PC for right now?
Yeah, I see this a lot as well. So much that most projects now, it looks like they're putting their platforms right into their Kickstarter description. And
yeah,
we did the same. It's for PC, Mac, and Linux. I can see why it's so important. It's the top question. If you don't own the platform, of course you're not going to back it, you know?
Yeah.
if it means you can't ever get it. So we got a lot of questions on if we'd ever port to consoles, if we would do Oya, maybe mobile platforms, things like that. And we're really focused in on PC, Mac, and Linux to start. It's a really good fit for some of the features of our game, like uploading your own art. Having access to a browser quickly is great for that, or your own drawing software. Plus, the mouse keyboard for control and aiming is really good for us. So
yeah,
we could do console ports, mobile stuff, but I think it's really becoming a very different game at that point, and I'd want to design for the constraints of those platforms. So if we do it, it's going to come after we really have a solid PC, Mac, Linux build.
And we also see like how a lot of builders put like those multiple platforms into their stretch goals.
Mm-hmm.
And as you talk about with some projects, it seems like it's almost like the developers are holding these additional features at ransom instead of developing first and foremost for the design.
Yeah, I'm also a little skeptical sometimes when I see a stretch goal that's only, you know, say it's the $1 million stretch goal, right? But the stretch goal right before it was 900,000. So this stretch goal's revenue is really only $100,000. And can they make a whole port of this game for 100 grand? I don't know. So yeah, some of the stretch goals I think are, I don't know if they're enough money to do what they're claiming they want to do.
Okay. All right. I think that's going to do it. Ken, do you have any other questions you'd like to ask?
Nope. I think we're good.
All right. In that case, we're going to wrap things up for this week's edition of the Perceptive Podcast. I'd like to thank Ken and Charles for being on.
My pleasure.
Yep.
And we would love to have you back on and talk more about Origins as it gets closer to alpha and even release.
That would be wonderful.
All right. And for those of you listening, as always, we are looking for guest writers and future podcast guests. If you would like to join us, feel free to send us an email. The link is on the front page. All right. And with that, we're going to say goodbye. So, have a good week, and we will talk again next time.